Casey took the dessert slice and touched two fingers to his faded Royals baseball cap. Miss Niecy, you spoil me. Hey folks, how are you? This is Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster, voluntarily broadcasting my lips off right here on the Mystery Hour on Sunsounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for joining me. Hillary Queen's Mystery Magazine and Twist Feel and bring us our first story. It's called Double Parked. The man was hard at work under the unsheltering Arizona sky. Dressed in iron chinos and a white polo shirt, he pocketed bills, made change, processed payments on his phone, pointed out empty slots. Behind him stood an easel sign. Parking $10, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. Cash or cash app only. No in and out. Cars left in lot after 6 p.m. will be towed. Six cars, turn indicators flashing, were waiting their turn to pull in. Letitia drove past them, pulled up at the curb, and lowered her passenger window. "Hey, Casey," she called as the man jogged toward her, the breadth of his cheekbones matching the width of his smile. "Well, morning, Miss Niecy. You parking today?"
No, thank you. The weather's perfect for walking. The heat'll be here before we know it."
She handed him a napkin-wrapped bundle. "Sweet potato pie, your favorite." Casey took the dessert slice and touched two fingers to his faded Royals baseball cap.
"Miss Niecy, you spoil me."
She beamed.
"My pleasure."
Baking was Letitia's hobby. After her husband passed 2 years earlier, she didn't want to give it up. She started bringing a homemade cake or pie to work every week, always saving a serving for Casey. One of the cars in the waiting line honked. With a wave, Casey jogged back to his post and resumed collecting payments and directing vehicles. The parking lot was across the street from the Civic Center and next door to the hospital, and the slots filled up quickly. Letitia pulled away from the curb and drove another four blocks to the municipal lot designated for city workers. The gravel was tough on her heels, but at least it was free. When the heat was at its worst in July, and back when she could afford it, Letitia would splurge on a space in the lot where Casey worked. Not wanting to walk the four blocks in 115-degree heat, one time the soles of her shoes had actually melted, leaving black tarry splotches along the sidewalk. Letitia's office was on the Civic Center fourth floor. Although she had a degree in accounting, she'd never taken the CPA exam. Laid off during the downsizing of the firm where she'd worked for three decades, she'd gotten a job 6 years ago as a financial consultant on the city's project to expand the airport. Whenever she needed a break from staring at spreadsheets, she'd walk to her office's narrow window, stand for a minute or so, knuckling her back and taking in the scene below. Her view was of the main street, mostly the parking lot. During the cooler months, it looked like a summer day in any medium-sized American city. Strolling pedestrians, diners queuing up at a food truck, top-down convertibles, kids playing in the park beside the parking lot. From June through August, though, it became the opening scene of a post-apocalyptic movie after climate change had run its course. Heat wrapped itself around the buildings and lay heavily on the street like a thick wool blanket, muffling both sound and movement. Cars glittered in the glare of the sun, door handles too hot to touch. Playground slides were blocked off to prevent third-degree burns on bare legs. The only people on foot were the carless, huddle-like pigeons in the scant shade of the bus stop, off-season tourists seduced by rock-bottom prices, and locals dashing from air-conditioned building to air-conditioned car and vice versa.
the parking lot dominating her view occupied slightly more than a third of the block, a square patch of asphalt between the park and the hospital. Its perimeter was bound by a thigh-high heavy metal chain strung between short metal posts, each painted royal blue. Six rows of nine slots, five on the right side, four on the left, divided by an aisle in the middle, were marked in bright white paint. To the left of the lot entrance was a shed, like the kind Home Depot sold, also painted royal blue. 10 months of the year, a taco and elote truck parked in front of it during lunchtime. Letitia used to treat herself to fish tacos once a week, before things changed and lunch became a piece of fruit and a sandwich made with bread from the day-old aisle. She'd once asked Octavio, the owner-chef of the food truck, where he went in July and August. "Home to Sonora," he laughed, showing gold-rimmed teeth. "It's too hot for me here, and I'm a Mexicano." Casey, though, never took a break. Rain or shine, temperate weather or inferno, the 60-something parking lot attendant was there every day in his chinos and polo shirt uniform and Kansas City baseball hat. On mornings when Letitia got to work early, she'd watch him unlock the chain that barricaded the lot entrance at 8 sharp, peeling it back like a string tab on a shipping box. When the lot was quiet during the day, she'd see him reading a book in the folding chair positioned in the shade of the shed, or doing exercises like jumping jacks and toe touches. On evenings, when she worked late, she'd watch the salmon run of business people stream out of the Civic Center and hospital, funnel onto the sidewalk and reclaim their cars, which then left the lot one by one, passing Casey as though he were a half-submerged tree in a river. When the last car was gone, or it was 6 o'clock, whichever came first, he'd walk the chain back into place, lock it to the post, and cross the street to the bus stop. In the cooler months, Letitia took her lunch break in the park, under one of the cottonwood trees. She'd started going more frequently after Dion died, needing a time and a place during her workday for the slow, quiet hardness of grieving. At some point, Casey started asking if he could join her. Most times she said yes, and now they ate together at least once a week. Letitia brown bagging it and Casey picking up something from the taco and elote truck. Sometimes they chatted and sometimes they sat in companionable silence, Casey reading and Letitia listening to one of her podcasts beside the clumps of prickly pear and brittlebush and saguaros that look like bristly green candelabra. Letitia enjoyed talking with Casey. It was like sitting next to someone on a long train ride, slowly diving into the details of each other's lives without any resulting intimacy or responsibility. Like Catholic confessions, she supposed, the freedom to unburden yourself without imposing on the person listening. Casey had lost a spouse as well. He'd first mentioned it when Letitia told him it was the anniversary of Dion's death and that even though it had been a whole year, and her friends said she should move on, she still missed him. "Yeah, people told me that too, but after I lost Renee, I didn't want to move at all. That's why I took this job. All I have to do is show up, unlock the chain, collect the money, lock the chain. In between, I can sit and think, read, or do my calisthenics. And always miss her. I get nice stretches of quiet. I'd never get behind a desk. The grief, it takes up a lot of space in my chest. This allows me room to deal with it," he smiled. "Plus, oh, I get to check out the cars. Over there, that's a Maybach. Tucked into a back row is the new Porsche. My favorites, though, are the convertibles. Doesn't matter what model. Always a good day when a ragtop comes in, especially a blue one. I like that my job keeps me busy." Without warning, tears welled, and Letitia dabbed at her eyes with a napkin. makes it easier not to think about Dion being gone. Casey propped his elbows on the picnic table and clasped his hands as though he were praying. Yeah, for me, it's the opposite. In this job, time creeps at such a slow pace, it doesn't feel like it's moving forward. I can imagine the moments are standing still that Renee has only just left. Not that it's been months, and then years, and then a whole decade since she passed. The next week, on her way back from the park after lunch, Letitia saw Casey touching up one of the royal blue posts. A car had bumped it, chipping the paint. She handed him an apple crumble slice. Sure that's in your job description? Casey took off his cap and blotted the sweat on his forehead with a rag. Well, work orders are running months behind. It's easier if I fix it myself. Well, I hope your bosses appreciate you. How long you been doing this job anyway? Well, 11 years next month. Casey resettled his cap. At first I thought, I'd stay here a year, maybe two. But the job market for guys my age, doing what I used to do wasn't great, and I started to like it. Oh, what kind of job did you used to have? I can't imagine you ever sitting behind a desk. No, I didn't. Not really. I was in charge of acquiring property for Beeld. Flew all over the western U.S. buying sites for subdivision strip centers, office towers. You worked for Beeld? The real estate and banking conglomerate was one of the largest in the United States. Yep, 20 years, well, till they fired me. Casey's tone was matter-of-fact. Said I was taking too much personal time. He pressed his lips together for a moment. Renee had just had her car accident and was in a coma. I'm sorry, Letitia said. What they did, that isn't right. Well, if it hadn't been that, it would have been, something else. Why keep on a 54-year-old when you can hire 220-somethings for less? He shook his head. Yeah, my last assignment was splitting my territory into two sectors and training my replacements. My ego wanted me to say no, but my common sense told me to say yes. Good thing I listened to my common sense. We needed the extra 3 months' pay. He shook his head again. Corporations. An acrid taste unexpectedly rose in Letitia's mouth. The words poured out, nearly unbidden. Governments, too. Half the people who work for the city are contract workers, including me. You're hired for 11 months, and then your contract comes up for renewal. At least it's almost always rolled over. Casey looked puzzled. Why not make everybody a regular employee? To avoid paying benefits. The law says you're entitled only after you've worked a year. Renewing your contract resets the clock. That means contract workers don't get things like paid holidays, overtime, unemployment. She forced a swallow, tasting bitterness. Or health insurance. Casey scowled. Oh, that's messed up. I know, but it's legal. Dion didn't have health coverage at his job either, so we had to buy our own. The only policy we could afford came with a $15,000 deductible. Letitia's mouth twisted. Dion wasn't even 50 when he got sick. More than a decade away from Medicare. He was a fighter, lived another 3 years after the doctors told him he had a month at best, and I'm grateful for every day I got to spend with him. Oh, but the costs. More than the deductible, Casey asked quietly. Yeah, way more. We blew by it every year. Had to take out short-term loans against the house to cover it. $45,000 plus interest. Her laugh was brittle. From Beeld Bank. If you can believe it. By the time we were broke enough to qualify for Medicaid, Dion was dead. How you doing now? I'm hanging in there. I still have my job, at least. Too bad your old boss doesn't think widows are a good contract workers or good credit risks. The bank won't give me an extension on the loans. At least they're letting me sign the house over so I won't have a foreclosure on my credit report. Appointment's next Monday. Casey's weathered face creased in sympathy. I'm truly sorry to hear that, Letitia. Well, I appreciate you listening. Everybody's got trouble, right? She looked at her watch. Whoop, 12:30 already. I better go. I hope you like the crumble. The next day, Casey brought two elotes to the park and offered one to Letitia. She didn't feel right taking it. Her finances might be tight, but how much did a parking attendant make? She was so sick of stale sandwiches and mushy fruit, though, that she couldn't resist. Oh, this is so good, Letitia said, after her first bite of grilled corn on the cob topped with a smear of mayonnaise, sprinkles of cotija cheese, and tajin chili powder. She took another bite, then pointed the corn cob at Casey. You know, we've known each other, what, 6 years? I've always meant to ask, what's the story with the hat? Did you used to live in Kansas City? Casey touched the cap's brim. Well, Renee did. Her parents moved there when they immigrated from Vanuatu. Vanuatu, it's a bunch of islands off the coast of Australia. Renee's dad loved baseball and followed the Royals. They have spring training here in Arizona, and we caught every game each year. Renee said that it reminded her of her dad. This was her hat. Oh, I've always wanted to live at the beach. Have you ever been to Vana whatever? Renee wanted us to go for our anniversary, but, well, then her accident. Letitia laid her corn cob on its wrapper. Casey, don't you want more? Casey frowned. More elotro? I'm pretty full. No. More, you know, life. Letitia wiped her hands on a napkin. Your old job sounded pretty interesting. Your life with Renee, too. Well, it was, but without her, you know, I get it, Letitia said. Trust me, I do. But I know Dion wouldn't want me checking out on life because he's not around anymore. Casey regarded her, his shoulders hunched. When Renee died, my heart broke. All I want is to be alone, just me and my memories of Renee. Unlock the chain, collect the money, lock the chain. Is 11 years of that what Renee would want for you? You've told me how full of life she was. Wouldn't she want you to go on living it? For her, for yourself. Casey tossed his corn cob in the trash. Excuse me, I got to get back. Wait, Casey, I didn't mean... But he was already walking across the park. When he reached the lot, he went inside the shed and shut the door behind him. Letitia spent the weekend packing and was ready for the movers when they arrived. Monday, mid-morning, most of her things were going into a storage unit. She'd rented a furnished apartment for a month while she looked for a longer-term place. The movers had everything loaded by early afternoon. The truck drove off and Letitia turned the key in the front door for the last time. She climbed into her car and sat there for a moment, looking at the house she'd shared for so many years with Dion. Only then did the tears come. She was 10 minutes late for her 3 p.m. appointment with Beale the banker. He met her in the lobby and escorted her to a cubicle. Letitia reached into her bag, her fingers finding a familiar shape. She pulled out a small replica of the Welcome to Las Vegas sign with a single key attached and laid it on the desk. She and Dion had eloped, and he'd bought her the keychain in the wedding chapel's gift shop. The banker set a sheet of paper in front of her. Well, here's the receipt. The courier left before we could prepare it this morning, so I need you to sign it. The lien should be removed by tomorrow, Wednesday at the latest. We'll email you copies, and the originals should arrive in the mail by next week. Letitia scrawled her name on the paper without reading it. She pushed it and the keychain across the desk. Here's the key. The banker looked puzzled. The key? You know, to your house. Oh, we don't need that. The repayment was made with immediate funds, so everything was canceled. The house is still yours. He smiled awkwardly. Well, as long as you keep paying the mortgage, of course. I believe there are 8 years left. Letitia felt dizzy, heart pounding. She grabbed the edge of the desk to steady herself. The banker looked at her with concern. Miss Nisi, are you feeling all right? Let me get you some water. An hour later, Letitia left the bank. The loans she and Dijon had taken out to cover the insurance deductibles had been paid off in full, along with an amount deposited in an account to cover any gift tax liability. The banker gave her the contact information for the lawyer who'd arranged for the funds transfer. Still in a daze, Letitia drove to work. There, she called the lawyer who told Letitia all she could say was a client had paid off the loans and set up the account and wanted to remain anonymous. Letitia called the moving company from her office, making arrangements to have her possessions picked up from the storage area and returned to the house on Saturday. She'd stay in the rented apartment until then. She walked to the narrow window and gazed out on the street. It took a moment to register that the parking lot was empty of cars. The chain was stretched across the entrance and the shed door was closed. There was no sign of Casey. That evening, on her way to the apartment, Letitia stopped at her house. She walked through the empty room, ran her hands over the kitchen counter, stood in the bedroom, and imagined she could smell Dion's aftershave. This time, when the tears came, she didn't try to hold them back. The next day, the chain was still across the parking lot entrance. Letitia parked in the municipal lot and, on her way to the building, stopped to knock on the shed door. As she stood waiting, she noticed a dip in the asphalt where Casey customarily stood. Over the years, he'd worn a groove in the pavement. No one answered. Was Casey sick? Hurt? She felt a stab of guilt. Had what she said made him depressed? What if he'd gone so far as to... A familiar truck pulled up to the curb. Letitia waved at the driver and hurried over. Hey, Octavio, have you seen Casey? She said after he lowered the window. The taco truck chef shook his head. No, yesterday and today, he has not been here. Do you have a phone number for him, you know, where he lives or anything? Oh, sorry, no. Letitia thought for a moment. How about when you got the permit for your truck? What did you put down for the landlord contact? Where do you send your rent? Octavio's eyes slid away from hers. No, there's no permit, no rent. Casey lets me park here for free, and I give him lunch every day, even though he never asks for it. He started the truck. I better go. My truck is full of food, and I have to find a place to set up. Letitia's job gave her access to city and state databases. Using property records, she discovered who owned the parking lot. BL'd Development. Taxes were current, automatically deducted every year from an account in the company's name. Didn't Casey say Bield had fired him? Maybe he didn't want her to know he'd taken a low-level job from the employer who'd done him wrong. Working her way through the conglomerate's phone tree, Letitia learned that unimproved property, including parking lots, was managed by Bield's acquisitions department. She was finally put through to someone named Richard. Yes, he was in charge of acquiring property for Bield in the western United States. Letitia gave him the parking lot's address. I'm trying to reach your employee who manages it. I'm worried about him, she said. We can't give out information on company personnel, Richard said. If you think there's an emergency, you could call the police. Could I leave a message for him? A sigh came through the line. Give me a minute. Letitia heard keyboard clacks. Richard came back on. Sorry, but that property isn't in my portfolio. I'll transfer you to my colleague. Before Letitia could respond, hold music started up. 5 minutes later, she heard another voice. This is Joseph. How can I help you? Letitia explained her request, heard more keyboard clacking. I'm sorry, but that property isn't in my portfolio. I'll transfer you to my colleague. Wait! Your colleague is Richard, right?
Yes, Joseph said. You and he are responsible for BL's property acquisitions in the western United States.
Yes, Joseph sounded more cautious now. And you were trained by Casey... Letitia realized she didn't know Casey's last name.
No, that name isn't familiar.
You didn't take over someone named Casey's job? Letitia said.
Well, no, that's not the name of the person who was in charge of this department before Richard and I joined the company. And as I said, the address you gave me is not in my portfolio. I can transfer you.
Letitia hung up and sat back in her chair. That property's not in my portfolio. The address you gave me is not in my portfolio. Bielt owned and was paying taxes on a parking lot, but didn't know it?
My last assignment was splitting my territory into two sectors, cash or cash app only. Work orders are running months behind.
That's easier if I fix it myself.
Letitia walked to the window and looked down at the royal blue bollards, the chain stretched across the entrance, the perfect white lines. Her accounting background told her how easy it'd be for a department employee at a real estate and banking behemoth to set up a hidden account to pay taxes on a property no one was responsible for. She counted the spaces, 6 rows of 9 slots, and then retrieved her phone and opened the calculator app. She did some quick math, multiplying the number of slots by how long he'd worked there, and stared at the total, 1,550,340. Even deducting the payoff of her house loan and the gift tax amount, that left $1.5 million. The small padded envelope arrived a week later, postmarked Port Vila, Efate, Vanuatu. She opened it and pulled out a photo of a man standing beside a blue convertible parked at the beach. His face was obscured by a blue Royals baseball hat, the same blue, Letitia realized, as the parking lot bollards. Her fingernails tapped the logo on the cap's front.
KC?
She smiled. More phone calls to Bield might reveal his real name, but she wasn't going to make them. Letitia typed Efate Vanuatu into Google. Images of white sand and blue water appeared, looking like the beach in the photo. Letitia's smile broadened. She looked up Vanuatu on Wikipedia. The island nation is part of French Polynesia. Tropical forests, beach resorts, tax haven. It was the last line that made her laugh out loud. Vanuatu is among the several countries that do not have an extradition treaty with the United States. Something else was in the envelope. Letitia tilted it and out slid a key. She looked at it for a moment before returning to the window where she stared down at the parking lot, specifically the chain stretched across the entrance. The one secured by a padlock? What had the banker said? 8 years left on her mortgage? Letitia closed her fist, feeling the edges of the key press into her palm. Well, as you might have surmised, Twist is local. Her description of third-degree burns coming down the slides, she knows exactly what she's talking about.
All right, I'm going to stay in that exact same Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. Just go back a few pages to a story by Kath Staincliffe, and it's called Swipe Right. He was lovely looking, outdoorsy, slightly weather-beaten, with a short beard and salt-and-pepper hair, and that smile. Oh, it was that smile that hooked her, made her feel warm and wanted. Shy, too, he was, and Caroline really liked that. Alex had been noisy, gregarious, and extrovert, and when she first lost him, she missed the sheer space he took up, the volume of him. But Thomas was quiet, not insecure, shy, but considered cautious. He'd think before answering a question as if giving it due weight. He even blushed occasionally when he spoke about his previous dating adventures. She'd never expected to feel alive like this again, excited, thrilled about the future rather than philosophical. They were in sync. Both widowed, both wanted to take things slowly. Open to friendship, if nothing more developed. "Well, he's hot," Caroline told her daughter as she dried the saucepans. "Don't you think?" "Mom." "Well, he is, but it's not like he knows it, not vain." "He's not asked you for money, has he?" "Jude, it happens." "He hasn't, no. And I wasn't born yesterday." "So when do I get to meet him?" Jude said. "Before I fly back?" "When we're ready. I haven't met him in person yet." "Oh, man, what if his picture, like, is 20 years out of date? And, hey, we video chat, Jude. I know he's not fake. He's 51, just like me." "Chat, is it?" Jude said, biting her lip. A wicked gleam in her eyes. "Stop it," Caroline shook her head, fighting a smile. "And that's certainly not happening online." "Oh, it's very popular," June swung her foot. "Different generation. If we get that far, it'll be in real life. Somewhere nice, a boutique hotel." "Out of wedlock?" Jude gasped, pressing her palm over her heart. Caroline threw the tea towel. When they did meet in person, Caroline felt the same visceral tug of attraction as when she'd first seen his profile on the app. After a few moments' polite preamble, the conversation flowed effortlessly, with an instinctive rhythm, like they'd known each other for years. And she enjoyed relating to Jude. Thomas was eager to pay for the drinks and the meal and only stopped offering when Caroline insisted that she had always gone Dutch and wouldn't be comfortable any other way, and he'd better get used to it. Before Thomas, Caroline had found it hard to imagine sex with anyone other than her husband of 25 years. She felt virginal in her apprehension. But each time they parted with a brief hug and a kiss on the cheek, Caroline hungered for more. She dreamt about him. She would wake aroused, alone and disappointed that it was just a dream. After Christmas, which Caroline had spent at Jude's in Madrid, she determined to broach the matter. Friday night, and they were having drinks in the bar they liked by the canal bridge. Her words were awkward. She stumbled over them as she made the proposition. What if she frightened him off? I'd like to take things further, Thomas. But if it's too soon, and you don't... It's not, and I do. He took her hand, kissed her fingertips, bit her knuckle. "Somewhere nice, somewhere special," she said, her stomach dissolving. They took a weekend in Archmont, a country house in Derbyshire. Any embarrassment melted away with the touch of his hands, the heat of his skin, the way he closed his eyes and parted his lips. Caroline was wild with longing. It was perfect. And if he snored a little in the night, a light purring sound, who was she to complain? In late spring, when they were walking a stretch of the Panin Way on a blustery day, he stopped, spotting a toad. They crouched to look. Caroline took a picture. She told him how they'd had a pond when Jude was little. At their first house, it was always seething with frogs at this time of year. When the froglets emerged and began to explore, some would get stuck in the flagstones of the patio, the spoony pads of their toes bonding with the limestone. Alex would go out each morning on a rescue and removal mission, wanting to spare Jude any distress. A prince among frogs. The toad croaked and wriggled away into the reeds. Thomas straightened up, offered her a hand. She took it and stood. He stared at her, scrutinizing.
Well, what?
Caroline said, the wind whipping her hair about. I want to spend the rest of my life with you, he said simply. Her heart bloomed, and me with you, she said, tears springing at the back of her eyes. They decided to buy somewhere new together. Thomas hoped to get £150,000 for his flat, and the estate agent valued Caroline's semi at £350,000. If mine sells first, Caroline said, we can always move while yours is on the market. We'd have enough for the sort of places we've seen.
Well, true, he said.
They'd been house hunting in Derbyshire, looking for a 2 or 3 bed properties with commuting distance of Manchester, somewhere to see them into retirement. Thomas worked as a consultant in computer programming, short-term contracts as a freelancer, and he could find work more or less anywhere, while Caroline would carry on teaching at college.
My inheritance? Jude joked when she heard the news.
Then, no, really, Mom, that's amazing. I'm so happy for you. Why don't you both come over here and have a holiday?
We will, Caroline said. We'd love to. But then they'd been so busy getting the house ready for viewing and sorting out all the bureaucracy.
They want certificates for every bit of DIY we ever did. Caroline complained to Jude, I haven't got half of it. In lieu of them getting to Spain, Jude was to introduce Thomas on one of their Skype calls. Caroline was relieved that they'd hit it off immediately. Part of her had feared that Jude would resent this new relationship, although Caroline had told her that no one could ever replace Alex.
It's done! Caroline rang Thomas, brimming with the news. Ah, the solicitor just called. The money's gone through, they've completed, and the removal firm are coming tomorrow.
She splashed out getting a company who would actually pack up all her things and put them in storage.
Oh, Thomas, I can't believe it. We should celebrate.
Oh, that's fantastic. I wish I were there. He was working down in Cambridge. But I should be finished here by Thursday evening, yes? Friday at the latest, how about the Hilton?
They let people like us in, she said.
Or we could go back to the Archmont.
Oh, yes, Friday, she said.
For the weekend? Just the night. There's still a million things to sort out.
Friday, then.
I'll book, and we really need to make a decision about which place to offer on, or I'll be sleeping on your sofa once the Whittakers get back. Caroline was house-sitting for her neighbors, who were in Australia for the summer, meeting their first grandchild. They were happy for her to stay there if her house sold, which meant she didn't have to sort out temporary accommodation.
You know you can sleep in my bed anytime, Thomas said, though his flat was pokey, only a studio, really, bought in haste after his wife's death.
Oh, I know, but I'd rather be sleeping in our bed, in our house.
We will, he promised, and soon.
I love you.
I love you, too.
She didn't get a chance to call Thomas until the following evening when the Packers had finally gone, leaving her house looking smaller somehow.
She felt a pinch of sorrow, a wash of nostalgia as she locked up. So many memories. Decades of her life and Alex's and Jude's. It was hard to imagine she'd never sleep here again, wake here, mark the seasons. She went next door to make something to eat. When she did call, she got a "This number is not in service" announcement. And the same the next morning. He'd probably dropped it in the sink or something. But couldn't he use a landline or email? Oh, then she'd chided herself. He told her the job in Cambridge was complex, something that would stretch the skills to the limit, but the fee would make it worthwhile. Caroline unpacked in their room at the hotel, her mind full of fond memories of the last time. Their first time. She poured herself a gin from the minibar, a local brand, in a pretty teal glass bottle, added tonic, and ran a bubble bath in the enormous clawfoot tub. She was so happy. It was a gift she'd never imagined. A second love. A second life, almost. Once she had emerged from the desolation of Alex's death, she had found equilibrium. Contentment, even. The grief returned, periodically swallowing her for a while, before spitting her out once more. But her life had been steady, if lonely, and now, she was so very lucky, so grateful. She dressed in a soft cotton wrap dress and strappy sandals, then opened the mullioned windows that overlooked the walled garden. Sitting in an armchair in the bay, she sipped another drink, reading and stopping at times to savor the view of the green velvet hills beyond the estate, the drifts of dark conifers in the valley. It seemed ridiculous to skip the evening meal. Perhaps the traffic was bad or Thomas had a last-minute hitch with work. So she ate alone. She asked them to save a dish for her partner who was running late. Why couldn't he get in touch? By bedtime there was still no word. He was in the hospital, a stroke, an accident, a burst appendix. He was dead. A car crash, an assault, a heart attack. At dawn, she drove home, exhausted and anxious, her stomach knotted and boiling. She changed and drank coffee, then drove to Thomas's flat. There was no answer when she pressed the buzzer. Should she report him missing? Ring around the hospitals? Peering in, Caroline saw a young man coming through the foyer and stepping back so he could exit. He smiled. Oh, morning. Have you seen Thomas Dawson? She knew she sounded panicky. To be? Oh, you missed him? Sorry? Oh, he moved out on... The man blew air through his lips, eyes casting upwards. Tuesday. Yeah. The landlord's already got a new tenant. Tenant? She was stupefied. This was some ridiculous mix-up. Where did he go? Oh, Bournemouth, I think. What? Bournemouth? As though she might not have heard it. He gave a nod and moved away. Think. Okay, think. Caroline ran after him. Do you have the landlord's number? Well, sure. He used his thumb to scroll through his contacts, held the screen up toward her. She took a photograph. Thanks. Yeah, no worries. Caroline sat in the car, sick and dizzy. Bournemouth. A new tenant. There must be a mistake. That's all. A mistake. They'd laugh about it. She made him laugh. She liked that, being able to conjure up witty comments and hear the break of his laughter like a wave crashing on shore. The landlord was unable to give out any information. Data protection? No, not even to family. Have you tried contacting him directly? Caroline hung up. She bowed over the steering wheel, dread lightly picking its way up the ladder of her spine. Something made her lift her head. A traffic warden, a young woman in motorbike gear, head cocked, a baleful stare. Penalty notice machine at the ready. Caroline raised a palm. I'm going. Mouthed. Thank you. He loves me. Sitting at the Whitakers' kitchen table, she waited for her laptop to load. He loves me, and I love him. The cottage in Buxton would be ideal. Walking distance to the train, just about. Yes, it needs lots of love and attention, but that would be fun. Doing it together, poring over catalogs and color schemes. The back bedroom had by far the best view up to the top of the fells. That could be their sitting room. She rang his number yet again. Still disconnect. The joint account. She launched the online banking site. They'd opened it with Lloyd's. Thomas had shopped around looking for the very best interest rates. With a large sum like this, it's worth it, even if it's only for a few weeks. Caroline looked up the details he had given her, which she'd copied into the back of her diary. I know it's not meant to be wise to write these things down, she'd said, but how on earth is anyone expected to remember all of their passwords? Carefully, she entered her customer number and then the numbers it requested from her PIN and the characters from her password. The bank sent a passcode to her phone to verify her identity. She typed the digits into the box on screen, leaned back and stretched her neck, took a measured breath in and out, and pressed Go to Account Summary. £50. Her stomach plunged. The balance of the account was £50, the amount they had used to first open it. Caroline crossed to the tall cupboard, helped herself to a tumbler of the Whitaker's brandy. She swigged it down, throat scorching, poured another. Caroline rang the fraud helpline. She was shivering as she answered all their questions. Her mouth grew parched, and her head was thumping. She was a victim, they told her, and unfortunately, with sophisticated fraudsters like this, there was very little chance of recovering any of the stolen money. The perpetrator might eventually be apprehended and face criminal proceedings. He's not a criminal, she wanted to say. She told no one else. Couldn't face Jude. Kept her at bay with regular sunny text messages about the weather and how busy she was. Caroline was off work on summer leave. They'd planned it like that so she'd have more free time to devote to the move. She ricocheted between weeping, wallowing in the photographs she had, scrolling through text messages, aching for him, trawling the internet, trying to find him. To raging against him, wanting to hurt him, punish him, and then to berating herself, her stupidity, her delusion, her pathetic neediness, burning with shame and humiliation. She drank steadily, heavily, from rising each day to oblivion. The cottage in Buxton sold, $15,000 above the asking price. Some nights she cruised the property pages looking for alternatives for when he comes back and everything is sorted out. The Whitakers had booked their flights back. She had another 3 weeks. The couple who'd bought her house were installing solar panels and cavity wall insulation and had not yet moved in. When they did visit, when she saw their car, she avoided them. Her bitterness grew like mold. Yes, she accepted she had been a fool, but him, he'd been a total bastard. She still had a few £100 in her old account. She hired a private investigator to try and trace Thomas. It was expensive, but then Thomas was a very expensive man. The private eye confirmed that Thomas's LinkedIn profile, the one she'd found when they were first in touch, was bogus, like everything else. The detective said he couldn't guarantee success. A fraudster like this would have gone to considerable lengths to conceal his true identity. So Caroline was surprised to be woken only 6 days later. It was almost noon. She couldn't remember getting to bed. She'd slept in her clothes. She felt shaky and dirty. I found him, the investigator said. He's alive. Her first thought and her pulse spiked.
an address in Glasgow. A name, Ian Williams, one of several he used. As agreed, the private investigator would prepare a report to pass to the fraud team. Caroline went to the hairdresser's. Cut and color, a shorter style, a lighter shade. She chose her favorite blouse, blue cheesecloth, and a cotton jacket that Thomas liked. Packed an overnight bag. Next door, a cherry picker was outside the old house, doing something to the guttering. The drive took all of a day. The landscape wilder the further she went. Glens full of heather and bracken. Slate-gray lochs, spruce forests. Reaching the city, she checked into the Premier Inn, only a couple of blocks from Thomas's address. A good night's sleep, guaranteed. Yeah, right. She could not eat. It was still light, a fine summer's evening with a balmy breeze. The blonde sandstone buildings of the city glowed honey in the sunshine. She parked on his street. She was steeling herself to get out of the car and cross to the building, anticipating his reaction. "Thomas," she rehearsed, "hello, love, I've missed you. Let's sort this all out." There he was, leaving the entrance. He was beautiful. He was wearing a pale pink linen shirt that she'd never seen before, the sleeves rolled up, and charcoal jeans, walking sandals, the ones she'd bought for his birthday. She wanted to touch him, to hold him, to feel his mouth on hers, his palm smoothing her hair, stroking her neck, her belly, her thighs. She wanted to make him laugh. He headed down the street, and she followed on foot. Thomas crossed a small park. Children were playing football, and a man shouted at a dog. A clutch of teenagers were seated in a circle on the grass, smoking skunk and drinking cans. Thomas, she couldn't call him Ian. She didn't know any Ian. "We can work this out, put it right, still do all those things we dreamed of. We were happy. We can still be happy." He turned onto a pedestrianized side street, all pavement cafes and bars, planters full of geranium and lavender and grasses swaying in the wind. "We can get an allotment near our house, grow our own veg and flowers, vases full, bright, blousy cottage garden flowers." Thomas stopped and sat at a vacant table. Caroline walked closer. Her hand was sweating on the knife handle, the kitchen devil's cook knife she'd selected from the Whitakers' block. The blade was concealed in the baggy pocket of her jacket. "I bought it for the pockets," she'd once told Jude, only half-joking. Caroline expected Thomas to sense her, to turn and see her. But when he did move, it was to stand and wave with his back to her. A woman, long silver-gray hair and a bronzed complexion, white-framed cat-eye sunglasses, a gray pinafore dress over a white T-shirt, white trainers, stylish, individual. "My age," Caroline thought. The woman raised a hand in greeting, and her face broke into a smile. She took off her sunglasses as she walked to Thomas, affection brightening her eyes. "You found it okay?" Thomas leant in and kissed her cheek. Caroline's neck burned. Heat flared up the back of her skull. "Oh, no problem." Caroline was closer, the screech of their metal chairs on stone drilled through her head. "Journey all right," Thomas said. "Oh, hen party till Preston." The woman laughed, one hand reaching for an earring, silver discs that caught the sun and made Caroline's eyes sting. Caroline reached the table. "Just tea, please. Earl Grey," the woman said. Caroline's hand tightened on the knife. "Nothing stronger," Thomas said, a warm invitation in his tone. "Oh, maybe later," she laughed again, delighted with herself, with the situation, their liaison. "For sure," he blushed slightly. "And I'll have..." Thomas's words dried as he looked up at Caroline. A ripple of confusion flashed across his face. The blood leached from his cheeks. He masked it all quickly with a full bright smile. "I'll have the same. But
you love me, and I love you. Caroline imagined swiping left, the knife slicing through his pink collar, through the skin and gristle of his throat, spilling blood, emptying him of his lies and falsehood, his monstrous treachery. The woman sensed the atmosphere and frowned. Ian? Caroline shivered. She could smell him, the salt and sage tang of his skin in his aftershave. She wanted to lick that skin, have him press her to the bed and tease her, gently, slowly, until she was crazed with desire. Come live with me and be my love, and we will all the pleasures prove.
Are you all right? Thomas said to Carolyn with such convincing concern that she wanted to weep.
She left the knife where it was, took a step back, then lunged, palms out, shoving Thomas off his chair with all her strength, with all her pain. She kicked the chair away and flung herself down, lay on him, clinging as if they were spooning, breathing in his scent, feeling the thud of his heart through her rib cage. She stayed like that through the commotion that followed, resisting all attempts to free him. She pinned him down until the police arrived. Then she let go.
Well, one woman scorned, another blessed. Kind of a yin and yang episode, wasn't it? That's going to do it for me, folks. I'm out of time. Thank you so much for joining me here on the Mystery Hour. And this is Keith Tyler saying, tune in again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.